Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and you're listening to Words on Film on WBCALP Boston. I will be reviewing some of the newest movies out right now. For this show, I have five new movies to review for you. Two of them are brand new for the weekend of April 12th through 14th, 2024, and the other three have come out in previous weekends, and I'm just getting to them right about now. So I'm going to start with the one that is probably going to be the most talked about film of the week, if not for the month. The first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Civil War, and this is the latest film directed and written by Alex Garland, who has made a name for himself over the last couple of years for having directed some very unique films, in addition to having written many of them. He debuted with his feature film debut in 2014 with Ex Machina, and this is not only the first feature film that he directed, it was the first film that he directed, period. He then followed that up 4 years later with Annihilation, starring Natalie Portman. And then, in 2022, he directed a film called Men, which did not do as well as Ex Machina or Annihilation, and it's probably no wonder, because that was a very, very weird film. Granted, Ex Machina and Annihilation had its weirdness as well, especially Annihilation, but Men was a movie that not a lot of people were prepared to see, and I know because I've spoken to some of them. Civil War is not as weird as Men or Annihilation, but very much like those two films, it depicts a very nightmarish situation. Unlike those two films, it depicts a nightmarish situation that could potentially happen. And Civil War is a movie about a journey across a dystopian future America following a team of military-embedded journalists as they race against time to reach Washington, D.C. before rebel factions descend upon the White House. So as the title of the movie suggests, there is a civil war going on, and I did have reservations, as I mentioned in my last week's What's Coming Up Next segment, that I don't think the movie should have been called Civil War. I think it should have been called something like Civil War II or America's Next Civil War, something that differentiates it from the only civil war that the United States has had from 1861 to 1865. It is America's first and hopefully, but it may not be, America's last civil war. I hope it is, but who knows what the future will bring. But the movie Civil War, even though it's the title of the film, leaves quite a bit to be desired, does depict what a nightmare civil war would be if it broke out in the United States today. I mean, in any country in particular, but most especially the United States, which hasn't had a civil war in over 150 years, even more than that. But anyway, the movie follows two photojournalists, one by the name of Lee Smith, who's played by Kirsten Dunst, and her partner in crime, Joel, who's played by Wagner Moura. And the two of them are followed by an aspiring journalist by the name of Jesse, who's played by a young woman by the name of Kaylee Spaney. And they first meet in New York City, which is not a safe haven for the Civil War. And the three journalists, two of them already established and one aspiring, go with another fellow journalist by the name of Sammy, who's played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, who, by the way, is one of those actors who is not a household name, but if you see his face, you could probably identify at least three other movies in which he's acted. Probably most notably, he's best known for having been in Steven Spielberg's epic movie Lincoln, where he acted alongside Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln during the country's real Civil War. But anyway, as this Civil War is going on, Lee and Joel in particular have the ambitious task of driving from New York City to Washington, D.C. in order to get an interview with the controversial president, who's played by Nick Offerman. And there isn't a lot that's shown about the president, but it is sort of reflected in the very beginning of the movie where you see Nick Offerman as the president rehearsing his speech that he is out of touch with what's going on with the country, and he wants to reflect that the civil war that's going on is going better for the right side. And as this movie progresses, you don't learn very much about the Civil War. You don't know why the Civil War is going on exactly, and you don't know who's fighting against whom and why. You also don't know who the right people on the side of the Civil War are. And that is great, because that shows you and reflects the senselessness of any war, but most especially a civil war. And I think that Alex Garland was very smart when creating his characters to make the focus on the photojournalists, who have a job to do in the sense that they have to show what's going on the front lines, but not interject their opinions about the war. And they have to be very professional in that aspect. And at the same time, it also shows that even if you're not fighting in the Civil War when you're on the front lines, how debilitating the scenes of war that you see, when you see people get shot and killed, how much of a toll that takes on your psyche. And also, there are some sacrifices that are made in this film here and there. There are certainly very beloved characters who meet their end. And I won't say exactly who, but the more you get to know these characters, the more heartbreaking their deaths are. And there are some scenes in this film that are horrific to see. That's certainly true. And there's also one particular uncredited appearance by Kirsten Dunst's husband, Jesse Plemons, where he plays a rogue soldier, and he is only in the film for about 10 minutes, but every second he's on screen, he's scary. And Jesse Plemons is an excellent actor. He doesn't necessarily play an antagonist, but when he does, especially when he plays a cold-hearted killer like the one he played in Breaking Bad, it's pretty scary, and he plays a sociopath incredibly well. That's probably the role that he plays the best. And seeing him in this film in particular, even though he's not credited, and his appearance could be considered a little bit more of a cameo, is still very impactful. But on top of that, everybody in this film acts incredibly well. I think that Kirsten Dunst turns in her best performance as a veteran journalist here who has seen it all, and you can definitely tell from her facial expressions and her body language that she's seen it all, but still there's enough in this film that even surprises her. I think she is the best actor in a film that's otherwise full of best actors, and very much like a good story, you don't exactly know where this film is going. You don't know whether the Civil War at the end is going to actually end when it does. You don't exactly know who's going to win. You don't know if it's good that this particular side wins. And that's all the more brilliant for Alex Garland, who is not American, by the way, to depict in this film. I don't know exactly what Alex Garland's thought process in writing and directing this film is, but he turns in a terrific film in a repertoire that is undeniable. You may not have liked Men, and that's not to everyone's taste, but this film, again, this is one that is not to everyone's taste, but it's not as weird as the film Men. But very much like his debut as a director and writer, Ex Machina, it's a film that shows the dangers, not to mention the fascination, of certain developments in human evolution. In the case of Ex Machina, it was the evolution of artificial intelligence, how it can be fascinating, but it can also have a very, very dark side. With a war, there's an obvious dark side, but there's also another kind of fascination where, as you are entering the Civil War with these photojournalists kind of vicariously, you're wondering what's going on. And even though the journalists in this film probably do know what's going on, and if you were to interject yourself into this film and you ask them, they could probably tell you who, what, when, where, how, and why in terms of how this war got started. But that's not really the point of the film. And what is the point of the film is how scary war can be and how the sides of the Civil War don't really matter. It's just the ugliness of the war that does matter, which is why I give the movie Civil War my rating of a knockout. I think it takes a prolific and very embedded writer and director like Alex Garland to make a very smart film out of what otherwise Hollywood would have put Gerard Butler in and made it a Cowboys and Indians-like thriller. But the fact that they didn't do that, and they presumably left Alex Garland to his own devices in terms of writing and developing this epic war film, was a very smart move. Again, I don't know the politics of Hollywood. I don't know exactly who edits the screenplay or who approves and greenlights for whatever reason, but whatever it was, they made a very smart film, and I believe this is Alex Garland's best film, and that's saying a lot considering the other three films that he has written and directed, which were prolific in their own rights. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, which is a remake of the film of the same name that came out in theaters in 1991 and was a critical and commercial failure at first. It's a film that was directed by Stephen Herrick and starred Christina Applegate, amongst other people. Christina Applegate was the headlining actress of the film. It also co-starred Joanna Cassidy, Josh Charles, David Duchovny, Kimmy Robertson, and other people. And it was a film about a family which consisted of a single mother and five children. And from what I remember from Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, the absence of the father is never explained. Presumably he died. And the mother goes on an extended business trip for several months during the summer, and she hires a babysitter to watch over the five of them, even though the oldest daughter is 17. But the babysitter dies very early in the film of natural causes, not of foul play, and the children have to figure out how to get the babysitter's body out of the house and to a safe place, and also how to fend for themselves during the summer since their mother is not there. And the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead had its charms here and there, but largely a lot of the problems that the family had could have been solved if they had just called an ambulance. After all, natural deaths, especially given the babysitter in that movie, do happen. But in the remake of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, the cast is largely African American, and the babysitter that they hire is played by June Squibb, who is one of the only white people in this film. And actually, the reason that the black family does not call an ambulance or the police when June Squibb ends up dead is very clever and very smart in the context of society today. If a white woman is found dead in a black person's house, the police, especially in Los Angeles, are going to have more than a few questions and maybe a few handcuffs, and that's putting it lightly. So I think that the disposing of the babysitter's body in this film, which happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie, is very smartly handled, more smart than the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And that's probably one of the biggest strengths of the movie. And the principal actors in this film include Simone Joy Jones, who plays the eldest daughter, Tanya Krendel, who is, I guess, sort of ipso facto watching over her younger three siblings during the summer where her mother, similar to the original film, is off on a business trip. The movie, as it goes, I think is in some ways better than the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, especially when it comes to the politics of, as I said, a white woman being found dead in a black person's house. That just screams so many questions, even though probably forensic evidence would tell them that, or would tell the authorities that no foul play happened. But still, it's a long process before investigators get to that point. But the rest of the film, I think, follows the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead in terms of its plot, in terms of the oldest daughter having to get a job and faking her way into a $60,000 a year job just to get food on the table for her other three siblings. That was also in the original. I think something could have been done a little bit more originally with that. And there were also some other plot twists that were almost copied word for word and point by point from the original film. And I think that was a pretty bad move. But largely, there were some parts of this film that I really liked. For example, I really liked the acting, especially by Simone Joy Jones in her first lead role as an actor. And there was also a really good supporting role in this film by Nicole Richie, who plays Tanya's boss, Rose. This was a role that was originally done by Joanna Cassidy in the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And Nicole Richie does a really good job with this. And I think that Nicole Richie as an actress is not given as much credit as she should be. And I think that's largely because of her earlier role in the reality show The Simple Life, where she was paired with a very bad actress, not to mention a very spoiled and entitled actress, Paris Hilton. Nicole Richie is no Paris Hilton. I think she was raised better than Paris Hilton, and I think she also takes her acting a lot more seriously than Paris Hilton does or did, and it really shows. So I love Nicole Richie in this, and June Squibb, at first, she's only in the movie for about 10 minutes because she is the babysitter that dies. And it's actually kind of a shame that they didn't give an Academy Award nominated actress like this more to do. But it is very amazing that June Squibb is 94 years old. She's even older than the babysitter in the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead by literally over a decade. And she is still acting, and she has four more films other than this that are coming out a little bit later. This could be the last film that's released while she's alive. I hope it isn't, but if it is, it's kind of serendipitous. But the remake here of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead has a lot more advantages over the original film, and I think it is largely a better film. There are some scenes that I thought could have been funnier, and I think that the movie could have trusted its storytelling instincts a little bit more by adding some more surprises that weren't in the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. But largely, I think that writer Chuck Hayward, who has written for a number of other shows before, like Mixed-ish and Everybody Hates Chris, and that's just to name a few, and those are some very smart shows, by the way. But I think that writer Chuck Hayward, who adapted this movie into what it ultimately was, did do some better character development here, not just for the character of Tanya, Simone Joy Jones's character, but also her three siblings were written very intelligently. And I just think that it's overall a better film, but it's still not great. And the reason it's not great is because, having seen the original Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead from years ago, I knew what some of those twists were. But it was a lot better than a remake probably had any right to be, which is why I give the remake of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead my rating of a checkout. I think in a lot of ways, in terms of character development, as well as some of the lines that these characters spoke, it was a much smarter film than the original. It was also a lot less morbid and less contrived. But when some of the plot twists of the original became embedded in probably the last 75% of the film, that's where the film faltered a little bit, but I still enjoyed it. And if you want to check it out for yourself, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead is out in theaters right now for a limited time, and it will appear on BET Plus if you subscribe to that on May 12th. So be sure to look out for it. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The First Omen, which is a prequel to the 1976 film that was directed by Richard Donner and starred Gregory Peck. And that movie, The Omen, was horror, yes, but it also had some thriller elements to it. It was a very big hit. It was a movie that put Richard Donner on the map in terms of being a prolific and respected director. And The First Omen is a film that is the first Omen film since the remake of The Omen, from 2006. But The First Omen is a prequel to the original Omen. And this is a film about a young woman who is sent to Rome to begin a life of service to the church. But she encounters a darkness that causes her to question her faith and uncovers a terrifying conspiracy that hopes to bring about the birth of evil incarnate. So that is the tagline. It's not the tagline, but it's the brief synopsis that's given to me here. But if you have seen the movie Immaculate, you will notice immediately the similarities between this film, The First Omen, and Immaculate. They both involve American women who go to Italy to devote their lives to the sisterhood. They live in a convent, and they also become pregnant by way of Immaculate Conception. Now, the twist behind the Immaculate Conception in the movie Immaculate is not exactly of the underworld, or shall we say, it's not considered satanic. It's considered weird and very disturbing, but not satanic. The First Omen, on the other hand, is about a satanic Immaculate Conception. And we are introduced to the main character in this film, Margaret, who's played by Nell Tiger Free. And I haven't seen her in many other films previous to this, but she makes a great lead actress. And there's also a priest by the name of Father Brennan, who's played by Ralph Ineson. And Ralph Ineson is a British actor whose name is not particularly well known, or at least not in the United States, but you've seen him in a number of films, probably, particularly some horror films. I remember him from 2015's The Witch, and I also remember not only how sick and twisted The Witch was, but I also remember how deep and how cool his voice was. And he certainly, he's not an antagonist in this film. He could have been, but he is the protagonist who warns Margaret about the Catholic underworld in this film. And also, the satanic parts of this film have a little bit more to do with the Catholic Church than you would expect, and probably not what the writers of The Omen intended in their origin story of Damien, who is the child of Satan that is in the original Omen and in many of the sequels. And this movie does have a lot of surprises, even if you compare this to the original Omen. And there are some parts in this film where it sort of has Easter eggs that pay homage to the Omen, but this film has its share of scares as well. And I liked it better than, A, I expected to like it, and B, I liked it better than Immaculate, because in Immaculate, I thought it was an original story, but there were some things that were lacking, and I also didn't really buy the twist in the film. I thought that Sydney Sweeney acted very well in it, especially in the very last scene, but I didn't get behind it as much, and largely because I didn't find it scary. My hands were by my side as I was watching Immaculate. However, The First Omen, and this is coming from a guy who's seen a lot of horror films, is a film where there were some scenes where I did put my hands over my eyes. Especially one scene where Margaret is in the dark, in bed, and there is somebody who's lurking in the corner of her bedroom. And I'm not going to tell you who it is, and I'm not going to tell you the context of the scene. I will tell you, though, that this scene is undoubtedly the scariest scene in the film. I also really liked a lot of the supporting performances. I mentioned Ralph Ineson previously. But there's also a nun roommate of Margaret, whose name is Luz, who's played by a young Italian actress by the name of Maria Caballero. And her scenes are not scary. She's actually probably a little bit more of the comic relief, and she also dispels some misconceptions about nuns in training in ways that A, are not scary, and B, are actually kind of refreshing for a film like this. She plays a really great best friend, and she isn't in a lot of the scary scenes, but I thought that she was a standout actress in this film. And overall, the certain prequels to especially well-established horror films, especially well-established horror films from the 70s, are hit or miss. But I'm proud to say, I'm happy to say, that The First Omen is in large part a hit. I think that a lot of the actors in this film act incredibly well. Nell Tiger Free is a great leading actress, and there are some great supporting performances by the likes of Ralph Ineson and Maria Caballero, in addition to some other very brief supporting performances by the likes of Charles Dance, who plays, surprise, surprise, a priest in this film, although he doesn't play evil like he's known to play before. But he does play somebody who is very pragmatic about the inner workings of the Catholic Church in this film. So The First Omen was a film that I did not expect to like, but The First Omen does get my rating of a knockout because it succeeded in what it should have been doing. It wasn't just a retread, just chock full of Easter eggs. It really was a legitimately scary film that told a good story that I think led very well into the story of the 1976 film. Some of the Easter eggs were a little bit more blatant than others, but it didn't make the movie bad. After all, I covered my eyes with my hands during some of the scenes, and that is the sign of a very good horror film. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Wicked Little Letters. And before I came on the radio to review this film, I kept saying to myself, don't call it Wicked Little Liars, or don't call it Pretty Little Letters. I'm alluding, of course, to the long-running freeform show Pretty Little Liars, of which I have never seen an episode, but the show is so well-known, if only by its name, that a similar-sounding title like Wicked Little Letters could eventually trip me up. So, a little bit later in this review, if I call it Pretty Little Letters or Wicked Little Liars or even Pretty Little Liars, please forgive me because that show's name is so embedded in my brain, it's really hard to forget. But anyway, Wicked Little Letters is a film that premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF, on September 9th, 2023. It debuted in the United Kingdom on February 23rd, and it was released in theaters in the United States and Canada nationwide on April 5th, 2024. And it was released in New York and LA before this. And it takes place in the 1920s in a little part or a little town in England that's called Littlehampton. And when people in Littlehampton, including conservative local Edith, begin to receive letters full of hilarious profanities, rowdy Irish migrant Rose is charged with the crime. Suspecting that something is amiss, the town's women, particularly one who works for the police, begin to investigate. And this movie is not exactly a true story, but it is based on a true scandal. And it follows an investigation into the anonymous author of numerous crudely insulting letters sent to the residents of seaside town Littlehampton, which is a real town for those who are not familiar with Great Britain's geography. And the conservative madam in this town is Edith Swan, and she's played by Academy Award-winning actress Olivia Colman. If this were a film that were made in the 90s, I feel like Brenda Bethan would play Edith Swan and be a shoo-in for that. I think Brenda Bethan might be retired from acting, but I'm not entirely sure about that. But yeah, this is one of those films where this woman is a frumpy older woman, but Olivia Colman's character has a backstory as well. In fact, not only is she one of the more conservative members of Littlehampton, but she also lives at home with her domineering father, Edward, who's played by Timothy Spall, who has a very prominent mustache and a strong personality to boot. And also her grandmother, Victoria Swan, who's played by Gemma Jones. And the Irish migrant is Rose Gooding, who's played by real Irish actress Jessie Buckley. And this movie, I think, can, in addition to being loosely based on a true story, it can also be kind of indicative of the times in which we live right now, where people can send anonymous messages via email or by way of social media platforms very easy. In fact, it is easier to be anonymous now than it was in the 1920s. But in this film, there are these various letters of profanity that are going out, just insulting the recipients by way of a number of curse words. And these curse words don't pull any punches, which is why this film is rated R. And it's rated R solely for language. So I think this would be an appropriate film for people who are 15 years old or older, maybe 13 years old, but you definitely don't want to encourage this kind of language if you are a bit of a prude. But this movie does have very dynamic characters, and I would say that this is Jessie Buckley's best role, but to be honest with you, I've seen Jessie Buckley in some American films, like I'm Thinking of Ending Things or Men, but I haven't seen her in everything in which she's acted, movies or TV shows. But this is not her first lead role in a movie, and this is the first movie I've seen her in where she plays her true Irish self. I mean, she plays a character who's not like herself, but she actually plays someone who's not hiding her Irish accent. And she is excellent in this film as somebody who is not a prude, and everybody knows it, but she becomes the number one suspect because these letters that are being sent out to various random people are full of the language that Rose Gooding uses on a regular basis. But some of the policemen, including one policewoman whose name is Gladys Moss, who's played by Anjana Vasan, is not so sure that Rose Gooding is the one who is the culprit. And the best part of this film is when Anjana Vasan's character actually begins to investigate very cleverly who actually sent the letters. And there's one scene where she finally nabs the person who wrote them, and she concocts this invisible ink to do so. And that's all I'm going to tell you about the ending. The letters, when you actually hear people read them, are very funny, and they reminded me of some of the parts of The King's Speech where Colin Firth, as King George VI, is trying to defeat his stutter with the help of the therapist Jeffrey Rush, and he does so by swearing. and he's not very used to swearing, so he's able to say the words, but he's not able to use them in the right or the believable kind of context that you would see him swearing. So yeah, there's a lot to unpack in this film. There are some scenes where the pacing of the film takes a bit of a sluggish route, but the last half of the movie, where you discover who's actually writing these notes and why this person is writing those notes is probably the best part about the film. And also, as usual, Olivia Colman is very funny at playing someone who is a conservative and a prude, and there are times where she's shocked, which shouldn't be funny, but from Olivia Colman, they are played very well for laughs, in addition to the fact that we all know that Olivia Colman can play funny very well from her role in The Favorite, for which she won an Academy Award for Best Actress. I can't say if she's going to be nominated for this film, but she does play in this movie very well, and her domineering father, Timothy Spall, is also very good in this film as well. And I got to tell you, Timothy Spall has been acting for decades. It's only recently where he's noticeably shed some weight. And after he's shed weight, he's played some very, very bad characters. And by bad characters, I mean he plays very bad people. But Timothy Spall is an excellent actor, and he plays these bad people really well. When he was a bit more portly, he generally played some protagonists very well as well, but it's just a noticeable trend for Timothy Spall. But the point is that this little town of Littlehampton is very cozy, and it's very quick to be brought into controversy, but when it gets into that controversy, it makes for a very fun film, which is why I give Wicked Little Letters my rating of a marginal knockout. The reason I'm not giving it a full, unenthusiastic knockout is because the first half of the film does have some sluggishness to it. It is not very well-paced, but as the mystery of who actually wrote these letters begins to unravel, that's when the film picks up, and that's when it really begins to become not only a unique film, but also a very fun film to watch. However, it takes a little while to get there, but while it's getting there, at least we have some great acting by the likes of Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley, Timothy Spall, and Anjana Vasan, amongst other people. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is In the Land of Saints and Sinners. This is the latest film that stars Liam Neeson, but unlike most of Liam Neeson's films over the last 10 years, it takes place in Liam Neeson's native land of Ireland. Ironically enough, the director of this film is Robert Lorenz, who is an American. But when Robert Lorenz was directing this film, not only did he insist on having a completely Irish cast, but he also insisted on having a largely Irish crew. And Robert Lorenz is previously known for his collaborations with Clint Eastwood as a producer for films like Mystic River and American Sniper, both for which Robert Lorenz was actually nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture, but he also directed the movie Trouble with the Curve, which starred Clint Eastwood and was not a hit. He also directed The Marksman from 2021, which starred, you guessed it, Liam Neeson, but The Marksman took place in America, specifically along the Rio Grande, where Liam Neeson played a police officer on the U.S.-Mexican border. But In the Land of Saints and Sinners brings Liam Neeson back to Ireland, but that's not just what makes this one of the better Liam Neeson films of the last 10 years. As those of you who have been listening to my show for the last few years have gathered, I've seen a bunch of Liam Neeson movies, and Liam Neeson's films have become very monotonous and hackneyed because he's always played an assassin who is on his last job, and he's very tired and weary from his job, and he's doing this one job before he retires. And this is kind of along the lines of his role in this movie, In the Lands of Saints and Sinners. However, he has more dimension as a character. His character's name is Finbar Murphy. Talk about a very Irish name. It's like Seamus O'Flanagan, and that's a name that I just made up off the top of my head. But rest assured, if you were to rent a movie that takes place in Ireland, you might find a character by the name of Seamus O'Flanagan, particularly if that movie that takes place in Ireland was actually made by Americans. But anyway, Liam Neeson plays a character by the name of Finbar Murphy, and he lives a quiet life in a small town called Glencolsill. And this movie takes place in Ireland in 1971, by the way, when the Irish Republican Army was wreaking havoc on Ireland and Northern Ireland in an attempt to get Northern Ireland to rejoin mainland Ireland, which is something that I, as an Irish American and a dual citizen of the U.S. and Ireland, hope happens someday. But I don't condone the methods of the Irish Republican Army for the way that they tried to make that happen. The Irish Republican Army may still be around today, but they don't have they aren't as terrorizing as they used to be. But in the 70s, that was a different story. And when Finbar Murphy returned to Ireland as a combat veteran of World War II, he found his wife had passed away and he fell into an alcohol-fueled depression. But then a local crime boss named Robert McHugh, who's played by veteran Irish actor Cole Meaney, rescued him from the bottle and put him to work using his combat experience as a contract killer. He finds, as he's posing as a bookseller, that there are agents of the Irish Republican Army who are wreaking havoc in his small town, particularly one who blew up a pub and not only killed the people inside, but also killed a mother and two sons who were unsuspecting victims inadvertently. And the primary Irish Republican Army agent in this film is named Dorian McCann, who's played by Academy Award nominee Kerry Condon. And like Liam Neeson, she is excellent and very well cast in this film. She is the antagonist of this film, but her character is very well developed. And there's also another role in this movie as where there is a police officer by the name of Vincent O'Shea, who's played by another Academy Award nominated actor, Kieran Hines, who, very much like Liam Neeson and Cole Meaney, have acted in American and Irish and British films for decades up to this point. And Kieran Hines is a bit more of a supporting player and not somebody who is active in the context of the story, but he is a very good supporting character in the sense that he is able to provide context for the events that are going on. But this movie does create a cat and mouse game between an assassin who's aging and also an Irish Republican Army terrorist. And Kerry Condon plays Dorian McCann very well, not only in the scenes that require to be cold and ruthless, but there is one scene where she kills somebody and then that person's mother wakes up from hearing the gunshot. And the way that Kerry Condon's character is able to A, talk her way out of the house without being seen, and B, reason with the aging mother is very well played. But there are some other good actors in this film as well, including one character by the name of Curtis June, who's played by Desmond Eastwood, who I don't believe is related to Clint Eastwood, but don't quote me on that. But Curtis June is an Irishman who is a very skilled assassin, but he also has an ambition to leave Ireland and go to California, where he believes life is simpler. It might be a little bit more simpler than war-torn Ireland, but it's not quite as simple in the early 1970s as he might believe. But that's the naivete of a guy in his 20s who hasn't left Ireland before. But In the Land of Saints and Sinners was one of those films I went into going, okay, here's another Liam Neeson film. I roll my eyes. It's another action film where he plays the same kind of character, but he doesn't. He plays a character who's actually and it's not one of his better characters because he's Irish. He's a better character because he's a lot more developed. And you know his backstory from the scenes that are shown rather than told. And you know what makes him tick. And it's a lot better than the other Liam Neeson films that have come out recently, where Liam Neeson is largely going through the motions. It's not Liam Neeson's fault as an actor. It's just in those other films, which Liam Neeson, I think, could put behind him now, hopefully, he's just not as developed, and the action scenes aren't as inspired. Here, it's not just bullets flying here and there, although a lot of bullets fly in the climax, but every bullet has a purpose, and you can feel every purpose in the land of Saints and Sinners, which is why I give In the Land of Saints and Sinners my rating of a knockout. It is a very pleasant surprise, and hopefully it represents an upward trajectory for Liam Neeson, whose repertoire has been largely monotonous over the last couple of years. It may have been the directing by Robert Lawrence or the incredible screenplay written by Mark Michael McNally and Terry Lone, but I also think that it's full of a lot of other great characters played by great actors like Kerry Condon, Desmond Eastman, and Kieran Hines, amongst other people. In the Lands of Saints and Sinners is a very violent film, but it's full of a lot of surprises, which can't be said for many other Liam Neeson films that have come out recently. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, and might I add, all the movies that I had to review for you for this show were pretty good to largely great. And that doesn't always happen. But anyway, it's now time for me to get into my final segment, which is What's Coming Up Next. This is a spoken word preview of movies that are subject to being released in theaters in the United States and Canada for the weekend of April 19th through April 21st. I would also reveal the movies that are going to be released on streaming, but I don't have time for that for the time that's given to me. But there are a number of films that are coming out in theaters nationwide, i.e. in the Western Hemisphere, or largely the United States and Canada, and I will tell you exactly what those movies are. On April 19th, 2024, there is a horror film that's coming out, a horror thriller by the name of Abigail. And this is a movie about a ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure who, after a group of criminals kidnap her, they retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they are locked inside with no normal little girl. And that is all I can say, because this movie seems like one that is full of surprises. The titular Abigail is played by a young girl by the name of Alicia Weir. And the movie also co-stars Dan Stevens, Catherine Newton, Giancarlo Esposito, and Matthew Good. A lot of really good actors there, especially Giancarlo Esposito. And this is a movie that I will see. I've already been invited to a sneak preview of it, and I will let you know what I think on my next show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters on April 19th is a movie that's called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. This is a film that stars Henry Cavill and is directed by Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie is a bit hit or miss when it comes to his films, although, honestly, compared to some of his earlier films like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, his movies recently have had far less confusing plots, which is good, but sometimes straightforward plots don't necessarily make a great film. But this film seems pretty straightforward, at least from the description here. In The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, the British military recruits a small group of highly skilled soldiers to strike against German forces behind enemy lines during World War II. The movie, in addition to Henry Cavill being the lead, co-stars Alan Ritchson, Alex Pettyfer, and Isa Gonzalez, amongst other people. Oh, some of the other actors, a bit more well-known, include Cary Elwes, Henry Golding, and Rory Kinnear. I was speaking early about one film where Rory Kinnear acted very well, but it was a very weird movie, the movie Men from 2022. But anyway, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is a movie that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters on April 19th is a movie that's called Sasquatch Sunset. This is a movie that takes place in the year of a life of a unique family. It captures the daily life of the Sasquatch with a level of detail and rigor that is simply unforgettable. This movie is directed by two men who are presumably brothers, David Zellner and Nathan Zellner, with a script by the former David Zellner. The movie stars Jesse Eisenberg, Riley Keough, Christoph Zajac-Denek, and Nathan Zellner, who also co-directs this film. So I don't know how this film is going to be. It sounds like a unique concept, and it has Sasquatch as the central character, not just the supporting character, like in movies like Harry and the Hendersons. But Sasquatch Sunset sounds like a very unique film. I guess Jesse Eisenberg plays Sasquatch, but don't quote me on that. But this is a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie, the last one I'm going to cover for this segment, that is going to be released in theaters or is subject to being released in theaters on April 19th, is a movie that's called Hard Miles. And this is a movie about a prison social worker who assembles a cycling team of teenage convicts and takes them on a transformative 1,000-mile ride. It is inspired by the life of Greg Townsend and the Ridgeview Academy cycling team. So this movie is a sports drama, but it also seems like it's a very uplifting sports drama. Among the actors in this film are some well-known ones, including Sean Astin, Matthew Modine, and Leslie David Baker, the latter of whom is best known as the black guy in The Office. And once I said that, you know exactly what he looks like. But this is a film that looks like it will be released in limited release. If I get to see it, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. That just about does it for this episode of Words on Film. Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, reminding you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at WBCA or the station as a whole. Until I watch a whole bunch of brand new movies, this is Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.